Well, thank you again for inviting me here in this amazing chapel or church building you have here. And I'm very pleased to be here and to see such a large congregation on a Saturday morning. I don't think that would happen over in England, but here we are. So I'd better get on with it because time is short and I've got to speak about William Carey. There's enough to say about him to keep you here till at least this time tomorrow night. So we better get on with it. I've also been asked to say something about myself, which I will be as brief as possible. I say that I was born between Liverpool and Manchester. I won't tell you when, but I was born there, brought up in that area, the northwest of England. I was converted by the grace of God in 1975 under the ministry of Alan McNabb, who at one time was a minister in Finnegy, not so very far from here, really. Came into the ministry, served in Suffolk, and then back into the industrial Midlands, where I was converted, and in another church, Ebenezer Baptist Chapel. I know chapel has a different meaning over here than it does, you know, so if I slip into that, you know what I mean. Baptist Chapel in Old Hill, near to Birmingham. Some say it's the second largest city, others say Manchester is. And I've been blessed of God. I retired about 3 years ago and been helping in theological college and so on, teaching church history since then, and preaching far and wide. So that's been a mercy. Pray for England, because there is a great shortage of preachers over there. That's why they have to have me. But so there it is. So I'm going to begin. Now, it's always good to begin with the Word of God. And I'm just going to read two verses, because these two verses are very much associated with the ministry of William Carey. And you'll find them in Isaiah chapter 54, and the second verse and the third verse of this chapter. Isaiah 54, verse 2 and verse 3. And they read as follows. Enlarge the place of thy tent, and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitations. Spare not, lengthen thy cords, and strengthen thy stakes. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. And so reads the inspired word. And we'll come to see why those were so important words for William Carey in a moment. Now, we might begin by saying this. One of the famous sayings of William, something he said of himself and something he wanted to be remembered by. And it was this. He said, I can plod, I can plod, I can plod. And he said, if anybody wants to know anything about me when I'm dead, tell them that. I can plod, I can plod, I can plod. It's the power of the plodder. Now, like most, or many, you could say, of the men and women God uses, William Carey came from a very, very obscure background. And I suppose as a young man growing up, nobody expected very much from him. But he was destined by the grace of God to do great things. He was born in a place called Paulus Pury. You want to say Berry, but it's Pury. Paulus Pury, which is in the south of Northamptonshire, in the Midlands of England. He was the eldest of five children, and his parents were Edmund and Elizabeth Carey. His father was a weaver who later became the village schoolmaster and the clerk of the parish church in that obscure village. William Carey himself was small of stature, the power of the little man, you could say. Slightly built, but with a passion for learning. He hardly had any formal schooling, but he was interested in a whole wide range of subjects, and all these subjects in the grace of God were to serve him later on in his life. He was interested in natural history, geography, in a big way in geography, languages, politics, biography, theology, and astronomy. And all those things captivated his mind. He wanted to know all he could about all kinds of things. But the two books that formed the basis of his life, of course, you can guess, was number one, the Bible, and number two, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. So that's the beginning of this man. Now, everything about him, though it didn't seem like this, everything about his early life, his childhood, was going to have some reference, some use in his later life. Even his name, William Carey. Because if you look up the name Carey, you see that it's Scandinavian in origin. You say, what's that got to do with it? Danish, in fact, in origin. And his forebears must have come over with the Vikings. And they were a warlike lot, as you know. And some of us say it was the Normans. But the Normans were Vikings, really. So he's got Scandinavian, Danish blood in his veins. Now, when he goes to India, finally, he sails on a Danish ship, the Kron Princessa Maria, a Danish ship. And he wouldn't have ever got started in his missionary work but for the help of the Danes. I'll explain that later on. So even that was part of the preparation for the rest of his life. I'll just tell you something about his voyage, because what we're learning about this plodding man was no difficulty seemed to be too much for him. He wasn't the man easily daunted or put off. Well, they had to sail for India. It was going to be a 5-month journey, voyage at sea. They set off on the 13th of June, 1793, and they arrived on the 11th of November, 1793. When the ship finally set off, they encountered, as you may guess, storms in the Bay of Biscay. After that, they were becalmed further down the coast of Spain. Then they hit a storm which carried them right across the Atlantic to the shores of Brazil. Can you imagine that? They're heading for England. They're ending up in Brazil. They didn't actually go ashore because the same winds and tides then carried them back to the Cape of Good Hope. Again, famous for storms, and they had a tremendous storm. It said, he said, Carey in his diary, he said that some of the waves were 50 or 60, not feet, but yards high, which carried the ship right up and then plunged it right down. And he said they went down on one of these troughs that he never believed they would come up from. They eventually get off the coast of India, the Bay of Bengal, and there they are becalmed for a month. And so it was. But eventually they get to India. Now then, we've said that he had in his childhood, go back to that for a minute, very little formal education. But in the providence of God, he was born at one of those times when men were dreaming dreams and men were seeing visions. It was that sort of a period. He had an uncle who'd been fighting with General Wolfe in Quebec and Canada. And this uncle had come back and fired him with voyages and adventures and wars and troubles to overcome. He was much inspired, of course, by the writings of Captain Cook. You know, Captain Cook was discovering Australia and those South Sea Islands and so on at this time. And it was all written down in a famous book, Cook's Voyages. He devoured it. Cook said it was impossible, as far as he could see, ever to convert the natives, the inhabitants of these far-off places. But Carey was not put off by that. He also was to learn that Captain Cook was killed by the natives in the Sandwich Islands in a terrible way. But he wasn't put off by that. But these voyages, and looking at all this geographically and so on, he made, because he's going to become a cobbler, we haven't got to that yet, a shoemaker. And out of leather, he made a globe. I don't know how he did it, but he made it. And it made him realize, under God, that these vast areas of the world were strangers to the gospel, never heard of it, fast bound in sin and nature's night. All that impressed itself upon him. So there he was. At that time, there was a preacher, a fiery preacher. His name was John Ryland. The two John Rylands in this story, one is Senior John Ryland and one is Junior John Ryland. The first one, John Ryland, sided with Washington in the American War for, you know, against us. So we don't mention it. But it fired William Carey with this idea of liberty, the liberty of peoples. He was a great man for liberating people, not by wars, but by the gospel. But he had that feeling was in him from an early age. Then when he becomes an apprentice, cobbler, there's another fellow there doing the same thing, and his name is John Warr, with two R's. W-A-R-R, John Warr. Now, this is God's instrument in bringing him to know the Lord. This young fellow, John Warr, was with a little group of people that were nonconformists, and they were meeting together. They hadn't yet properly formed themselves into a church, but they were meeting together, and through this group, he comes to know Christ as his Savior. Now, remember, his father was the clerk of the parish church, Church of England. But his father wisely didn't object to him associating with these dangerous nonconformists. He encouraged him, and there was the wisdom of his father. But anyway, he comes to know the Lord. I'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment. But we should also remember at this time, you've got George Whitfield and John Wesley and other people like that. They're there under God, preaching up and down the country. This is all going on. Clarkson and Wilberforce, they're campaigning against the slave trade. And it's this atmosphere in which he was born. It's the same period when Adam Smith wrote about the wealth of nations. That's all about economics and so on, really. But when you read it, that man, Adam Smith, he says that all these lands are opening up, opening contact, getting into contact with them, and so on. And he said, but it's an opportunity not only for trade, but for the spread of the gospel. It surprised me when I saw even a man like that was interested in the spread of the gospel. Anyway, same time, Jonathan Edwards had been experienced revival, and there was this humble attempt to promote explicit agreement and visible union to God's people to engage in ordinary prayer for revival, to give you the full title. So revival, prayer, the works of God were going on. Same time, Warren Hastings, I'll stop telling you all these things in a minute. Warren Hastings had been one of the Governor Generals of India, had been dismissed, brought to trial. He hadn't done anything wrong. He was found not guilty. But what it did, it opened up people's eyes to what was really going on in India. And Carey sees this, and it's used of God. And one final thing by way of this introduction. It was the time when hymn singing was becoming widely popular. And you have all these great hymn writers from Isaac Watts onwards. But one hymn particularly laid hold of William Carey. It was by the Welshman William Williams. And it was this, you may know it. O'er the gloomy hills of darkness, look, my soul, be still and gaze. All the promises to travail, should say, with a glorious day of grace, blessed jubilee. And then this was it. Kingdoms wide that sit in darkness, grant them, Lord, thy glorious light. And from eastern coast to western, may the morning chase the night, and redemption freely purchased win the day. That took hold of his mind, and he thought, this is the work I am being called to do. But he's, remember, he's just a cobbler. He's just a shoemaker. He might have been a laborer in the fields, as most men around there were at that time. But he had something that burned his skin by being out in the sun, so they had to give him another job, and he became a cobbler. Well, if I had time, I'd tell you about all the cobblers that have been in history that became great men. It's surprising, you know, a great long list you could find of famous people who started off as shoemakers. But anyway, we won't go into that. But the shoemaker to whom he'd been made apprentice, his name was Clark Nichols. I think of Clark's shoes, but I don't think there's any connection. But anyway, this man Nichols, he had a library, a small library in his house. And William Carey had the temerity, I suppose, to ask him, could he see it? Could he look at it? And he did. He allowed him to. And there began his interest in some of these subjects, expanded the interest anyway. But one thing he found in that library was a commentary, Bible commentary, but it had in it many references to the language Greek, to Greek, as you would obviously expect in a commentary, perhaps. And he's intrigued by this language. He wants to learn Greek. He's only a young fellow, 14 years old. He wants to learn Greek. And he discovers that there's a fellow in the village that the writers say had led a dissolute life. He was a no good. A scoundrel, really, but he was highly educated. And William Carey went to him and said, "Sir, you know, do you know how to speak Greek?" "Yes." "Would you teach me?" "Yes." And so, in that strange way, using whatever things were available, as it were, whatever opportunities were there, this man taught him Greek. Nearby, in the town or village, really, of Olney. We've heard of Olney before. John Newton was there and so on. William Cooper or Cowper was there. But at this time, Thomas Scott was the incumbent at the parish church there. We've heard of Scott and the famous Scott's Family Bible. You may even have one at home. And he got to know... Carey got to know him, and this man, Scott, Thomas Scott, was very, very helpful to him spiritually and in every way, encouraged him. Also at that time, nearby town or city of Leicester, there was another minister, Robert Hall, famous for a book called Helps to Zion's Travelers. And again, this same man encourages the young fellow, Carey. It's a good thing to do, isn't it? To encourage young men. If you see any spark there that needs fanning into a flame, do it. And these ministers did that very thing. Now, at this time, this man John Waugh, remember, who he was working alongside, and a few others were trying to form themselves into a little church. They were meeting together, interested people, godly young people mainly, meeting together in somebody's house or whatever it was, and eventually come to want to form a church. They did actually form a Congregationalist church in the end. But these people, they wanted to have ministry morning, Sunday morning, Lord's Day morning and evening. But they could only afford to pay somebody to come in the morning. So what do they do in the evening? Well, they decide they'll work it out amongst themselves. Each one will bring his portion, as it were, like a shared meal, only a shared spiritual meal. And so they did. And they all brought their bits that they learned or the Lord had laid on their heart. But it soon turned out that Carey, William Carey, was saying the most, not because he was gregarious, but because the Lord's hand was upon him. And sometimes he spoke with such fervency and depth, they broke out into applause when it finished. Well, he was embarrassed by this, but he put it down that they didn't know any better. They were unchurched, but they were seeking the way of God, and so they went on. Well, this happened. Now, eventually, this congregational church became a Baptist church. Don't ask me how or why, but it did. Now, the Baptists had what they called associations. You no doubt have them, you know, the presbytery and so on. And they had these meetings whereby various churches all came together, a special meeting like today we're having. And he comes into contact with men there. They not only encouraged him, but were going to be useful to him later on. One was Andrew Fuller. And this man eventually became the secretary of the missionary fund that they, the missionary society rather, that they formed together. But on this day, when he went to this association meeting, he was so poor, it was rather like today again, you're all bringing your own food. Now, he was in such financial straits that he couldn't do that. So he finds himself going the whole day, it was a whole day affair, going on into the evening, with nothing to eat at all. He didn't tell anybody, nobody was aware of what he was doing, but he got nothing to eat. But then, so the story goes, a certain man, Mr. Chater, invited him when the meetings was over, because he'd got to walk quite a few miles back home by then, invited him to his house. Some say for something to eat. Others I've read say he's still, nobody still can give him anything to eat. But let's say he did get something to eat. But he got more than something to eat. This man, Mr. Chater, had formed a church about 6 miles away from where this little place where Carey was. And he said to him, well, we've been watching you, Carey, and we'd like to call you to be our minister. This is a big development. Now, he accepted, but he couldn't leave the other place. So he said, I'll go to one place 1 week and the other place the next week, alternate weeks. But that meant to go to this church, he had another 6 miles to walk further on than where he was regularly going to. He did that. They did pay him, but he said they didn't give him enough money even to provide enough shoe leather for the shoes he wore out walking back into to these places. This man virtually lived on nothing. Anyway, all these things are there as he starts off in life. Now, I've got to move on fast here because time is running away. We haven't got anywhere near India yet. So I'll try and condense this a bit now. Now, after this, he is called to two other churches. He is growing, getting bigger churches all the time. In fact, this same man, Andrew Fuller, I mentioned a few moments ago, he said this. He said, every young minister ought to begin with a small church. It's like cultivating a garden before you try to cultivate a field. Well, I don't know whether that's wise or not, but that's what he said to him. Well, he went to these bigger gardens. One was in a village called Moulton, still there today, and the other was in the city of Leicester. But both of these churches were full of trouble. You know, some ministers are sent to churches where there is trouble. They don't always realize it when they go, but I'm sure that's not the case here. But these two places could not have been more troublesome. They almost broke him. Well, anyway, they didn't break him. He said that he was distressed beyond measure at the trials of this situation. But on his mind was the matter of mission, overseas mission, and in this case, India. There was another one of these association meetings coming up, and he decided he would broach the matter at that meeting. And so he did bring the matter up. What about our churches being engaged in overseas mission? Well, if he got trouble in his church, he had trouble in his association now. Because this man, John Rylands Sr., who I mentioned a few moments ago, was furious at his suggestion. And he came out with a bit of very unsatisfactory theology. He said this. Well, he started off by saying to Mr. Carey, the young man Carey, You are a most miserable enthusiast, sir, for asking such a question. And then said, followed it up by saying, certainly nothing can be done before another Pentecost, when an effusion of miraculous gifts, including the gift of tongues, will give effect to the commission of Christ as at the first. Well, I don't think that was sound theology for a start from such a noble man as Mr. Ryland. But anyway, he finished his little tirade by saying this, young man, sit down. When God pleases to convert the heathen world, he will do it without your help or mine. Shut up, sort of thing. Well, that's putting somebody in their place, is it not? Was he daunted by this? No, it doesn't seem as if he was daunted a bit. He goes back to his troublesome church in Leicester, and he begins to write this book. It's still in print. It's got 112 pages. It's not massive, but it's an answer, really, to John Ryland Sr.'s tirade, arguing that mission, overseas mission, is a vital part, is an essential part of the ministry of the Church of Jesus Christ. And it's a very well thought out thing. It was only a shoemaker, but my word, he had a brain. Anyway, he did that. And when he came to move to the church and had a ordination service, he read this out. After the ordination service, he decided to read the contents of this book out to those that were gathered there. As I say, 112 pages, so I don't dread to think how long this service went on for. You may think I'm keeping you this morning, but this is nothing to what Carey did. Well, anyway, he did that. And then he got it printed. He had to get a printer. He had to find a printer in Leicester that would do it. It's surprising, the printer that he chose, because this printer was very highly involved, well, not involved, but influenced by the French Revolution. So he was a revolutionary printer. A short while after he printed this, this same printer published or printed Tom Paine's Rights of Man, anti-Christian publication, if ever there was one. So he was a strange printer to choose, but nevertheless, this book was printed, and it goes on from then. Coming up next was another one of these association meetings. He sells copies of this book there, and then after that, also, they asked him to preach. And this is where the text comes in. Isaiah 54, 2-3. Enlarge the place of thy tent and let them stretch forth the curtains of thine habitation, etc. Isaiah 54, 2-3. Now, nobody wrote down, nobody took any notes of this famous sermon. But you can divide it up into two parts. Expect great things from God. That was the first part. That's a great vision, isn't it? We have a great God. Expect great things from God. Our view of God is too small, is it not? And the second part was, therefore, attempt great things for God. You've got it. And that was the gist of it. And after it, there was a small meeting in which those interested were led to form a missionary society. They passed the hat round after it for funds. It wasn't a hat, it was actually a silver snuff box. And they passed it round, and they got in the box when they came to add it up, £13.02. Well, it wasn't a big fund, really, to start a missionary society with, but they did. And later on, other funds came in, and in the end, this group interested in forming the missionary society came into contact with a man called John Thomas. He was a man, and they didn't know really, but he'd been in India as a missionary prior to all this, virtually on his own, a rather eccentric fellow, and he'd come back to try and get help, to to go back with him. And they decided that William Carey would be the man. Whether they were just going to get rid of him, I don't know. But they decided he was the man, and he himself thought, this is the call of God. This is what my whole life has been leading up to. And so it was decided they give him 5 months preparation. I should say he was married by now, and her name was Dorothy. This was going to be a tremendous strain upon her, which broke her in the end. But anyway, they gave them 5 months to prepare. They had to go then to the East India Company. They were the powerful company and figures that were there in India at that time. And nobody could really enter India from England without their permission. And so he went there to London to get this permission. But he couldn't have gone at a worse time, as far as humanly speaking goes, because the East India Company, up to this time, had allowed no missionaries. They didn't want any missionary coming, upsetting the people over there, upsetting the natives. They just wanted to keep things calm and trade and so on. Now, two men. One of them was a part of the committee of the East India Company. His name was Charles Grant. And another man, the famous William Wilberforce, at that time, had put before Parliament the desire or the request that the East India Company acknowledge the need for missionaries and put such a clause in its constitution that missionaries would be allowed to go. So that was brought before Parliament, but it was thrown out. And remember, the Parliament was full of bishops and so on at that time, but it was still thrown out. And so they said to Carey, no, you can't go. Now, what did Carey do? Well, this is where the Danes come into it again. He hears that there is a Danish ship, the ship we mentioned earlier, the Crown Princess Maria, sailing from Dover round about that time. And what do you think? He was on it, and his family, and they sailed. Now, they did something, I don't know what you would think of this, but they made this 15,000-mile journey in the way I described at the beginning. And they find themselves in the Hooghly River, which is a tributary of the Ganges, on the banks of the river as they sail into it. You see crocodiles and all that sort of thing. His wife is absolutely terrified. She can't face it. He doesn't bother at all. He's not going to bother to face him in the least. But anyway, they're not going to go into Calcutta. The ship's going there. But they get off before that, and they get into a native boat and land somewhere quite a few miles from the capital. And there is a place called Deb Hatta, if I pronounce it right. And as soon as they get ashore, this is illegal, really, but they get ashore, and as soon as they get ashore, the John Thomas, I should call him Dr. John Thomas, he preaches to the people who were there. There was a kind of a bazaar or market there, and he preaches in the native language for 3 hours. And there it is. And they ate their first meal in India, which was served up on a leaf. So there they are. Now, this fellow, John Thomas, he was a good man, but he had no idea how to handle money. And within the first few weeks of being there, he'd spent the whole of the allowance for that period. And so what did they do? Well, he was quite inventive, and he managed to get work in an indigo factory. Somebody he knew, I'll tell you the name, Moy Pal Diggy. And there he was working in this indigo factory. And he also, in another nearby factory, the same indigo factory, got a job for William Carey. And before he knew it, William Carey was supervising 90 men. He's gone as a missionary, but he's supervising a factory. But again, he's unfazed. He quickly learns the language, Bengali, and before very long, he can preach and hold out for about 30 minutes in a sermon in Bengali. He's only been there weeks, and he's picked this up. And before long, whilst he's doing this, he has visited 200 villages with the gospel message and established two schools Well, surely the hand of God was upon this man. But all this was beset with difficulties because the area flooded. You know, areas of India are very susceptible to flooding. The two factories were destroyed with flooding. Came typhus fever. His son, 5 years old, he had seven children, but his son, now five, dies of the fever. His wife, Dorothy, is pregnant again. All this pressure is pulling her down. She is beginning to get the first signs of mental breakdown here. And all this is going on. Well, the factory was ruined, but he gets another job in another factory some 12 miles away. And by this time, he's desperate. And he sends home for help. Must have help. The harvest is ripe. The laborers are few. And before he knows it, others are there. William Ward is a man who comes. Joshua and Hannah Marshman are others that come. And there they are. But they don't arrive. They've been impounded by the East India Company. They can't land. They can't go out from where they've landed, sort of thing. And they're stuck. But then comes along another Dane. If I pronounce his name right, he's Colonel Ole Bye. I think that's how you spell it. I'll pronounce it B-I-E. But anyway, this fellow, he is really the regent of the Danish protectorate of Serampore. And that's quite a few miles away from where they are, 300 miles away to be precise. But he says, if you come with me, you'll have the freedom in Serampore and district to evangelize all you like. And they went. And Serampore became, in the end, the headquarters of William Carey's activities there. Now, I must hurry on. Now, as time went on, we get to the year 1800, and various things happened then. It's where the first convert is made. He'd been there 7 years plus, and the name of the man was Krishna Pal. And if I had time, I would read to you the hymn that's in several hymn books that Krishna Pal wrote after he'd been converted. But anyway, Krishna Pal is converted. There's a long story attached with that, but I haven't got time to tell you. He was their first Bengali convert. But something else happened at this time. The British government really wanted, they'd opened a college called Fort William College in Calcutta. And they wanted somebody that could speak Bengali and some of the other dialects to go there and teach the government officials that were now arriving to run the place. So they couldn't speak the native language, and who could they find to teach them? Well, there was only one man there that could do it, William Carey. And so the government relented on all these other prohibitions, and he went there and taught. Not only did he do that, he taught Sanskrit and some other languages, but they offered to pay him £600 a year to do it. And later on after that, they offered him £1,500 a year for doing it, which was going to fund all his activities. They were going to buy a steam press. They had a publication section there in Serampore, which at that time was the biggest output in the world of missionary and scriptural literature and so on. It was astonishing what was achieved through all this. I have to tell you that he lived in Serampore, and Calcutta was 8 miles away. And there was a river running between the two, of course. So when he went there, he went 3 times a week. He rowed there in a rowing boat, a 16-mile round trip before you start work. How would you like to row 8 miles before you start work in the morning? But he did it. This is the sort of man that he was. Now, setbacks, yes. The whole place burned down shortly after this. All his work, you have probably heard this before, hours of work translating, so on. I can't tell you how many of the dialects that he translated the scriptures into, running into tens, 50 possibly, all lost. And what did he do? he saw it as an opportunity to improve the translations and began again from scratch. It would have destroyed anybody else. When news reached home of what had happened, £10,000 came in by way of donations from England or Ireland or wherever, and they soon made up the loss. But this man is undaunted. Worse than that, I nearly finished though, worse than that, a rumour went round in England, was circulated in England, that these men were living in, as they said, Oriental luxury, and we were all paying for it. Well, he was living in abject poverty because all this money, hardly any of it, was spent on himself. That hurt him more than the loss by fire and so on. All these were parts of the trials. Anyway, very quickly now, the legacy, the lasting legacy of William Carey. Now, what can we say about this? It's huge. Well, one thing is, we do have this book, which is a challenge to anybody to read. Another thing that came about out of it was that the East India Company, we mentioned, opened the doors to missionaries going in any parts of their territory. So that was something very important that was carried out. The second thing is this, is teaching, scriptural teaching, gospel teaching, was directly opposed to the Hindu mindset that gripped India at that time, and is gripping it again today, you might say. You see, the Hindus believe this, that creation was either the dream of God, or an illusion, or even divine itself. Creation, what is it? It's a dream that God had. That's pretty vague, isn't it, to describe creation. Or it's an illusion, doesn't really exist. Or it's God himself. Now, the result of this was that we can't understand it and we can't be responsible for it in any way. The physical world around us is in a state of flux, and though there are troubles and trials, we can't do anything about it. We just do nothing. We just accept it all. Well, that's a pretty dismal, depressing, discouraging way of looking at life. Well, he's challenging that, you see. And then, of course, idolatry was everywhere. And the Hindus believe this, that human beings are free to decide whether a stone is God or a tree is God or actually anything is God. If somebody says, well, I think that's God, that's my God. As it happened, a lot of women took the line that their husbands were God. Well, oh, you're all laughing, ladies, but well, that's what some of them thought. But it's more serious, you see, because when the husband died, their God had died, and the only thing they could do was to die with him. So they practiced that which was called sati, which when the husband was burned on the funeral pyre, they lay on it by the side of him because their God was dead. Their world was at an end. A terrible way of looking at life. Now, William Carey abolished that by his ministries and by his connections and so on. Again, we're taught, the scripture teaches us, that man, we are all made in the image and likeness of God. In other words, everyone is important. Everyone is worthwhile and so on. But in India, they didn't have that, you see. So infanticide, killing of unwanted babies, well, that's nothing. There's only babies, get rid of them. And people with leprosy or any terrible disease, it's nothing to do with us. We don't want anything to do with it. Just cast them out. The value of human life was nil. So he challenges that. Apparently also, I've gone over my time 7 minutes now, but give me two more. The landscape of India at that time was what you might say downright ugly. In towns, certainly, in cities. What did he do? He introduced the planting of trees and forestation. He would probably have been quite up to date in that, in some people's eyes. But all sorts of things. Again, he encouraged or introduced the famous Protestant work ethic, There were people coming over from England who thought they'd get a job in India, they could do what they liked and didn't have to do any real work, just live a dissolute life. He challenged that head on. And then above all that, you may say, they were just the offshoots. Above all that, he was preaching the unique, the unsearchable gospel of Jesus Christ. And that man we mentioned, Krishna Pal, was the first convert. But it goes on and on and on. That was the beginning of what he did. His printing press, over a 30-year period, produced 212,000 gospel messages through literature and so on. I can't tell you all the other things that he did. I have to rush on now just finally to give you the last sort of minutes of his life. He was visited on his deathbed by Alexander Duff, the famous Scottish missionary that was following him. And they spoke, and then Mr. Duff was going to leave. And Carey, with his final breath, almost said, "Come back, come back, come back, Duff." And he said to him, "Don't talk about me, talk about the Saviour," which went to Duff's heart, really. That's how he died. On his tomb were these words. Well, William Carey, born 1761, died 9th of June 1834. "A wretched, poor and helpless worm, on thy kind arms I fall." And that's how he lived, and that's how he died. There is ever so much more we could have said about this man. But there's a man, started off with nothing, you may say, not thought of, plodded on through great difficulties, but a man of extraordinary faith and extraordinary labour, not saved by works, we know, but they're the evidence of a genuine faith in the heart. And what can be done by ordinary men using whatever talents God has given them? We better stop now.